Imagine this. Your eyes flutter open in absolute darkness. The air is thick, stale, pressing against your lungs like a heavy blanket. You try to move, but your arms are pinned by unyielding walls, wooden, cold, unbudging. Panic surges as realization dawns. This isn't a dream. This is a coffin. You're 6 feet under, surrounded by the crushing weight of earth. You scream, but the sound bounces back at you, swallowed by the dirt. Your fingernails scrape desperately at the lid, splintering, bleeding. Above, the world carries on, oblivious. Is anyone listening? Will anyone come? This is taphophobia, the primal fear of being buried alive. And if you think it's just a relic of old horror tales, think again. History whispers otherwise. Real people have faced this terror, some by cruel accident, others by human malice. Tonight, we'll unearth those stories, layer by layer, until the soil feels too close for comfort. Welcome to True Crime Sleep Stories. Tonight, we're delving into the suffocating shadows of one of humanity's deepest dreads. Settle in and get comfortable, but not too comfortable. Dim the lights, pull up the covers, and let the darkness wrap around you as you lie there, safe in your bed. Or are you? What if those sheets feel a little too tight? What if the quiet of your room starts to echo like the inside of a box, deep underground? This episode will soon have you squirming, questioning every creak and shadow. Are you ready to face the grave? Our journey begins not in fiction, but in fact. For centuries, the line between life and death was blurrier than we'd like to admit. In the 18th and 19th centuries, medicine was rudimentary. No EKGs, no brain scans, just a mirror held to the mouth, or a feather to check for breath. Conditions like catalepsy, where the body stiffens into a death-like trance, or cholera epidemics that left victims comatose, fooled even the best doctors. People were declared dead, mourned, and interred, only to awaken in horror. Historical accounts from Europe and America document exhumations revealing scratched coffin lids, bodies twisted in agony, fingers gnawed to bone. This wasn't rare folklore. It was a documented peril that sparked widespread panic. Enter taphophobia, the irrational, but actually entirely rational, fear that gripped society. Writers like Edgar Allan Poe amplified it in tales like The Premature Burial, where protagonists claw at their confines, hearts pounding in eternal night. But Poe drew from reality. In 1822, Dr. Adolf Gutsmuth of Germany tested his own invention, a coffin with a feeding tube and a rope to ring a bell above ground. He volunteered to be buried in it for hours, emerging to prove its worth. 7 years later, Johann Taberger patented a similar design, ropes tied to the corpse's limbs leading to a bell. And in 1897, Count Michel de Carnicci created a spring-loaded system. Any movement would pop open an air tube, raise a flag, and toll a bell, alerting graveyard watchers. These safety coffins were born of desperation. Patents flooded in, over 30 in Germany alone during the late 1800s. Some had ladders for escape, others viewing tubes to check for life. Waiting mortuaries, or Leichenhäuser, sprang up in Europe, where bodies lay for days under observation, fingers wired to bells. If the bell rang, resurrection. But here's the chilling truth. Despite all these innovations, there's no verified record of a bell saving anyone. Decomposition could shift bodies, ringing false alarms. Rain, wind, animals, all could mimic the desperate pull of a living hand. The bells became symbols of hope, but often rang hollow. Yet the fear persisted because the stories did. And some stories were all too real. Let me take you back to a sweltering summer in 1915 in the quiet town of Blackville, South Carolina. This is the tale of Essie Dunbar, a story rooted in historical reports, though shrouded in the mists of time and local legend. Essie was a 30-year-old woman, unassuming, living a simple life amid the cotton fields and dusty roads of the American South. She suffered from epilepsy, a condition poorly understood back then. Seizures that could strike without warning, leaving her limp and unresponsive. One fateful day in August, Essie collapsed in a violent fit. Her family, terrified, summoned Dr. D.K. Briggs, a local physician. He arrived, examined her still form. No pulse, no breath, no signs of life. With a heavy heart, he pronounced her dead. Grief swept through the household. Funerals were swift in the heat. No embalming for many poor families, just a quick burial to beat decay. They scheduled the service for the next morning at 11 a.m. at Beulah Baptist Church, giving time for Essie's sister, who lived out of town, to arrive by train. The body was washed, dressed in her Sunday best, a simple white gown, and laid in a plain pine coffin. Mourners gathered under the relentless sun, the air thick with hymns and sobs. The minister, Reverend H.J. Perry, delivered a eulogy on the fragility of life, how death comes like a thief in the night. As the congregation sang, "Nearer my God to thee," the coffin was lowered into the fresh-dug grave. Shovels bit into the earth, clods thumping onto the lid like final punctuation. But Essie's sister was running late. Train delays, the bane of rural travel. She arrived just as the last dirt was patted down, breathless and distraught. "Please," she begged the ministers and gravediggers, tears streaming. "Let me see her one last time. Just open the coffin so I can say goodbye." The men exchanged uneasy glances. It was irregular, but compassion won. They grabbed shovels and began digging, the crowd murmuring in hushed tones. Sweat poured as they heaved the coffin back to the surface, prying off the nails with crowbars. The lid creaked open, and there sat Essie Dunbar, alive, smiling faintly at her sister. Chaos erupted. Mourners screamed, fleeing in terror. Some convinced she was a ghost or zombie risen from the dead. The ministers, in their panic, tumbled backward into the open grave, one breaking his leg, another spraining an ankle. Essie, dazed but unharmed, climbed out with help, her gown muddied, her eyes wide with confusion. She'd been in a deep epileptic coma, not dead at all. The cool earth, the enclosed space, it had somehow preserved her just long enough. Word spread like wildfire. Newspapers later recounted the tale, though the earliest accounts surfaced decades after, in 1955, upon Dr. Briggs's death. the Augusta Chronicle reported Essie outliving her doctor, picking cotton at age 70, a local curiosity. Some whispered she was undead, avoiding her in the streets. But Essie lived quietly, marrying, raising a family, until her true death in 1962, 47 years after her first burial. Was it exaggerated folklore? Historians debate. No contemporaneous records confirm every detail, but the core aligns with Era's medical mishaps. Epilepsy victims were often misdiagnosed and hasty burials common. Essie's story endures as a testament to resilience and a warning of how thin the veil between life and death once was. Now imagine that terror not by accident, but by design. Shift forward to December 1968, a time of social upheaval, Vietnam protests, and moon landings on the horizon. But for 20-year-old Barbara Jane Mackle, an Emory University student and heiress to a Florida real estate fortune, the nightmare was earthly and man-made. This is no legend. It's documented true crime, a kidnapping that shocked America. Barbara was the daughter of Robert Mackle, co-founder of the Deltona Corporation, a booming development firm worth millions. She was bright, poised, studying at Emory in Atlanta, far from her Coral Gables home. In mid-December, a flu outbreak hit campus. Hong Kong flu, they called it. Barbara fell ill during an exam, feverish and weak. Her mother, Jane Mackle, drove up to nurse her, planning to bring her home for Christmas. They checked into room 155 at the Roadway Inn Motel near campus, a modest spot with thin walls and neon signs buzzing outside. That night, December 16th, Barbara's boyfriend, Stuart Woodward, visited, bringing comfort and chatter. He left around midnight. Mother and daughter settled in, Jane in one bed, Barbara in the other, the room dimly lit by a bedside lamp. At 4 a.m., a sharp knock shattered the silence. Jane, groggy, peered through the peephole, a man in a ski mask claiming to be police. "Stuart's been in an accident," he said. Alarmed, Jane cracked the door and chaos exploded. Two intruders burst in, Gary Stephen Christ, 23, an escaped convict and lab tech with a genius IQ, and Ruth Eisenman Shear, 26, his Honduran accomplice, a marine biology student. Christ wielded a shotgun, Eisenman Shear, a chloroform rag. They subdued Jane, binding her hands and feet with tape, chloroforming her into unconsciousness. Barbara, terrified, was forced at gunpoint into their blue Volvo station wagon. "You're being kidnapped," Christ snarled. They drove into the pre-dawn chill, Barbara blindfolded, heart racing. Christ had planned meticulously for 2 years. Obsessed with ransom schemes, he targeted wealthy, resilient women, someone who could endure his twisted test. Barbara fit. Tough-minded, from a rich family, they'd scouted her, knew her routine. In a remote pine forest in Gwinnett County near Duluth, Georgia, they'd pre-dug a trench 18 inches deep. Waiting was a fiberglass-reinforced box, 7 feet long, 3.5 feet wide, 2 feet high. A ventilated capsule, not a coffin, but close enough. It had air tubes snaking to the surface, a battery-powered fan, a light, which soon failed, jars of water, canned food, sedatives, and a mattress. A perverse life support for short-term burial. Barbara, stripped to her nightgown, was forced inside. "Scream all you want. No one will hear," Christ said, snapping Polaroids of her holding a kidnapped sign for proof of life. They sealed the lid with screws, shoveled dirt over, camouflaging with leaves. Barbara lay in pitch black, the fan whirring faintly, air tubes her lifeline. Panic clawed at her. Suffocation fears, claustrophobia. She screamed until her throat was raw and pounded the walls. Hours blurred, cold sweat, labored breaths, the earth's weight pressing in. To survive, she focused, recited prayers, imagined Christmas with her family, rationed water. "I refused to die," she later said. Back in Atlanta, Jane awoke, freed herself, called police. The FBI mobilized, over 100 agents. Christ phoned Robert Mackle and demanded $500,000 in ransom, unmarked bills in a suitcase. The first drop was botched. A cop spooked them, but the second succeeded. Robert left the money at a Miami marina. Christ retrieved it, fleeing to Florida swamps. Clues mounted, ransom notes, the box's unique design. Christ built it himself. On December 20th, Christ called with coordinates. "Go to the White House on Berkeley Lake Road." FBI swarmed the woods, digging frantically with shovels and even hands. At 4:15 a.m., they found the site, air tubes protruding like snakes. "Barbara, we're here," an agent shouted. They unearthed the box and unscrewed the lid. Barbara emerged, shivering, dehydrated, and 19 pounds lighter after 3.5 days. "Thank God," she whispered, hugging rescuers. She was unharmed physically, and her spirit remained unbroken. Christ was captured days later in the Hog Island swamp, and the $480,000 was recovered. Eisenman Scheer became known as America's first female on the FBI's most wanted list and was nabbed in Oklahoma. Christ got life in prison, but was paroled after 10 years and became a doctor in Indiana, his license later revoked for fraud. Ruth served 4 years and then was deported to Honduras. Barbara married Stewart, had children, and co-wrote the book 83 Hours Till Dawn with journalist Jean Miller. She lived life quietly as a survivor. Now, picture this. It's 1850 on a foggy London evening. I'm Eleanor, a seamstress felled by fever. Doctors whisper, "She's gone," and my family weeps. They bury me hastily, cholera raging through my body. But later, I awaken to darkness. Silk lining brushing my face, air thin, chest heaving. I thrash. Nails splintering wood. A rope dangles, tied to my wrist, leading to a bell above. I yank it wildly. The sound cuts through the night. A watchman hears and digs furiously. Earth cascades. Light pierces. I gasp sweet freedom. But was it real? Or just the echo of countless untold stories? The bell tolls for us all, eventually. These tales, Essie's accidental escape, Barbara's deliberate entombment, tie into our primal dread. Safety coffins promised salvation, but reality delivered mostly silence. Taphophobia lingers because it's universal. Helplessness, isolation, the slow choke of air. Modern medicine, embalming, and monitors have buried the risk. But the fear? It simmers below the surface. Essie defied death by sheer luck and her sister's plea, living decades more. Barbara endured through sheer will emerging to reclaim her life. Both stories highlight human error and malice, yet also resilience, symbols of hope in the dark. Thank you for listening to this episode of True Crime Sleep Stories. If these tales chilled you to the bone, share your thoughts in the comments, subscribe for more nocturnal nightmares, and leave a 5-star review. It helps the show reach more sleepless souls. Until next time, snuggle in tight, sleep with one eye open. Good night.